Accession number 28776, Reel 21.
Admiral Ray Ligo, Reel 21.
So he then looked round the ball pit and he looked and he said, oh, he didn't say anything. There was a complete silence. And the first chap to speak it up was Alan Greenwood, who was then the deputy chairman, had been a member of the All British Aircraft Corporation Board. And he said, well, I think Ray's got a point. And I thought, crikey, got a point. I think I have. And then Tim Pearce, who was the only non-executive, no, he was one of the two non-executives on the board. He was from with Esso at that time. And he said, well, I agree with Alan. I think Ray has got a point. So Pesic looked around the board and he said, well, what do you suggest, Sukhi Mila? I said, oh, well, I think you should get each member of the board to write to you giving his opinion. And he said, I want nothing in writing. Except from you, Ligo. I want to see what you have to say. Oh, all right. Didn't bother me at all. So I went back with all my vast experience of 2 months or whatever it was in this company. And I wrote a report, or I wrote a letter to him, and I said, we are concerned, or we should be, about increasing the efficiency of our organisation. Because if we're not efficient, the world is changing, and we're going to have to compete in a worldwide environment, and we have got to be as efficient as we possibly can be. Now, sadly, I said this with my tongue in the cheek, because I was talking to a socialist, sadly, we haven't found any way of measuring efficiency other than by profit. Now, as sad as this may be, it remains a fact that unless we are profitable, we are not going to survive. And I can't see how we can be profitable in a nationalised environment, because profit is not allowed to be a measurement. So I think we should embrace privatisation, because unless we do, we're not going to survive. Well, that was it. Of course, the company was privatised as soon as British Aerospace came in. They announced they were going to privatise it. And I was then approached by a chap called Kenneth Warren, I think it was, who had been, I had known him in the days of Marconi, and he was now a Member of Parliament for Dover or somewhere, and was elected or selected as whatever they call it, permanent under secretary, not permanent under secretary, but one of the junior ministerial posts in the Department of Trade and Industry. And he approached me and said, Ray, I'd like you to attend a luncheon that I'm going to organise in kind of some hotel in London. And there will be a special guest there, which I can't tell you who it is. Anyway, so I turn up at this hotel at the prescribed time, and he arrives and ushers in Adam Butler, who was then the Secretary of State, or Shadow Secretary of State, or about to become the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, or one of the senior ministers, I think. They actually had Keith Joseph at the top of this organisation. But Butler was the secret and very important person that was ushered in. And so we had lunch and chatted about industry and then came to the point of the meeting, which was, who did I think should become the chairman of British Aerospace? Well, I said, well, I don't have very much experience so far to give you too much guidance. Let's go through the possibilities. There's George Jefferson, who was then my boss. I said, he, I think, is the most efficient manager that I have come across so far. There is the chap, what was his name, for God's sake, who was running the aircraft side. But I said, he's going to retire, he's up to retirement. So he's not really eligible. Alan Greenwood is retiring very shortly, within 6 months, so he's not eligible. And so I ran through all the board people. And I said, then there's Ligo. And old Butler said, oh, I don't think we should. I said, no. Please listen to me. I rule Ligo out because he hasn't got enough experience at this point in time. Maybe in time it would be possible, but not now. And so he, and I said, so my recommendation is George Jefferson. So there was that meeting. Then it's back at Stevenage, at the new headquarters, which George had managed to have erected. He sent for me one day after we moved into these new buildings, a matter of weeks, and said, how's it going, Ray? And I said, oh, it's fine, if you like a view of the dustbins. I said, that's where my office is, looking out over the back. Well, I don't, oh, he said, I'm worried about that. He said, because you'll be in this office soon. And I said, oh, really? How is that going to come about? Well, he said, I'm going to become the chairman of British Aerospace. Oh, I said, are you? You know this? And he said, well, the board has agreed it. And I said, but George, it won't be down to the board. It will be down to the permanent under secretaries club in London, in Whitehall. They'll be the ones that decide who to recommend, and it will be a political appointment. And he said, well, I said, well, have you checked out any of these people to find out whether they're supporting you? And he said, no. And I said, well, would you like me to do it? Because I know nearly all of them, and I can go in and find out. And he said, well, I'd be very grateful if you'd do that. So I walked back down to my office thinking, well, I'd better start with the Ministry of Defence, I suppose. And he came running after me and said, on second thoughts, Ray, I'll do it myself. I thought, now you've blown it. Because these chaps will look you straight in the face and say, oh, I think you can make an excellent chairman, and drop a black ball straight in the bag. Whereas with me, they would skate around it, but I'd get a firm impression one way or the other. And sure enough, of course, he was not appointed chairman of British Aerospace. I had been asked about the non-executive director, the only one that was really available at that time and on the board at that time, which was Tim Pearce, and I said, well, I really don't know anything about him because he only turns up for board meetings. Sometimes he's very late, sometimes he has to go early because of his other commitments. I really don't know much about him. He never doesn't open his mouth very much. Anyway, it was he who they decided to appoint, and not George Jefferson, which was a tremendous mistake. But that's what they did. Now, why? It was a perceived understanding at that time that anybody in the oil industry who rose to the top must be a genius. If you looked at what Austin Pearce, he had run an SO subsidiary at Fawley. He had risen to run the SO company in the United Kingdom, which was a subsidiary of the SO Holland, which was in turn a subsidiary of Exxon in the United States. So what he was actually doing was really running a fleet of tankers. And his actual knowledge of how to run a privatized company was very limited. I didn't realize this at the time, but looking back at it, that, of course, was the fact. And so here we were going into privatisation with a new board. They'd appointed Austin Pearce as chairman. He selected a new bunch of non-executive directors, all of whom individually were good men. I was then running Dynamics. Ivan Yates, I think by this time, had replaced his other chap who'd retired and was running the military aircraft division. John Glasscock was the deputy to him, and I had the chap who was deputy to me in Dynamics. We had a retired Air Chief Marshal, Peter, it's gone, on the board as a kind of, make weight. John Stamper, who was the technical director and a very brilliant designer, who had been one of the authors of the NA-39, which became the Buccaneer. And who else was there? Oh, the finance director. Now, the other thing was they brought a finance director in, or Tim Pierce did, from ESSO. And again, you see, I don't think we had the, events showed that we didn't have the technical expertise that one needed. Anyway, we were then to be privatised and sold off, and our shares were rated at whatever they were at that time, not much. And suddenly, out of the woodwork comes a chap that was running then, Peter Leister, who was running EMI. And he decided, he went to see Norman Tebbit, who was then running that part of the Department of Industry, and said, if I was to offer you a fair price for the shares in British Aerospace, because the government's retained half at that time, half were for sale, would I be able to buy it? And he said, yes. So along comes this chap and says, well, I've been told I can buy you. And Tim Pierce, it must have been quite a shock for him, because it would have appeared that this fellow had worked for Tim Pierce in a previous life. And here he was coming to say he was going to buy the company, and that would have been the end of Tim Pierce, no doubt. So, when I was told this, I said, well, I think we'd better have words with them to find out what, you know, their capability is to run this part of British Airways, the whole of British Airspace. So a meeting was set up in which I was to go along and talk to them. Meantime, Tim did something which was turned out to be the right policy. Whether he did it deliberately or by accident, I have never really known. But what he said to Leister was, I'm sorry we can't discuss this matter at the moment, because we're in the closed period prior to the announcement of our results. And therefore, I won't be doing anything for a few weeks until we've had the annual general meeting. And then we can discuss it. So he said, oh, fine, that's all right. So I went and met a lot with this board, and I found it most unimpressive. I really couldn't see how they could run anything, but even a fried fish shop. And I thought, well, I don't know about being bought by this lot. It doesn't seem to be very sensible to me. But meantime, Leister had said, Ligo, I want you to stay whatever happens and run the whole place. I thought, well, that's very flattering. But he said, I won't want Tim Pierce. So I thought it my duty, and I went and told Tim Pierce, probably a mistake again on my part. I should have kept it to myself. I didn't. I went and said, and by the way, he doesn't want you to be any part of the organisation. So this went down like a lead balloon. But, I mean, that was the truth. So the moment came with the annual general meeting, and Tim Pierce opened the meeting by saying, before we start with the results, etc., of the company, I should tell you that we have been approached by EMI to buy the whole of British Aerospace. The analysts in the audience ran for the telephones, and I've never forgotten that. And, of course, our share price just started to go through the roof. Because it was open, it was quite clearly this was open season on British Aerospace. As a result, in the end, the share price got so high that Leister couldn't afford to buy it. So that really saw him off, but it was an abject lesson to me, because one of the great statements that was made at the time of privatisation was, it is the government's present intention to keep 51% of the shares. Within 10 minutes, that present intention had been overtaken by events. And so don't ever believe anyone who says it is my present intention. It might be then, but it may not be tomorrow or the next day or even 5 minutes' time. So we had a... we were now more or less floated and on our own. But when the share price was set for flotation before this event, of course, we didn't have the right financial advice. We had Kleinwerk Benson then advising us. But looking back on it, the one thing they should never have allowed was for the privatised British Aerospace to take with it all the liabilities that had been created by politicians in the socialist government before, like Airbus Industry, for example, like the 146, which they had decided to launch against advice in order to keep up manufacturing and employment capability at Hatfield, and an aircraft that was to become a kind of like a lead balloon around our necks, because it wasn't really, although it was a very good aeroplane in its own right, but it had little problems, but basically there was nothing wrong with it, except the market for it, you know, if you're going into that lower range of the market, it's so competitive. And what also I didn't realise at the time, and I don't think anybody did in British Aerospace, was that because British Aerospace had been largely concerned with building aircraft for the Ministry of Defence and for government, therefore to achieve 65% of availability for a weapon or an aircraft system was considered good. Whereas if you were selling commercial aircraft, they had to have at least a 98% availability. Otherwise, you know, they were, became, the people operating them started to lose money, and they just wasn't on. And we didn't understand this. And when I reorganized the civil aircraft side of British Aircraft, of BAE, the only people I could find to bring into the commercial side, of course, were coming from the military side. And their idea of what competition was non-existent, because they never had to face it. So it was a difficult period. But we achieved, in dynamics, two breakthroughs. One was Sea Eagle, the standoff weapon for the RAF to use against... or the Navy, to use against ships at sea from the air. And Sea Eagle was effectively a cruise missile. It went in at a low level. And it was competing with Harpoon and everything else, and we won it. And that was considered to be an amazing achievement. And Drunkie Lewin, whom I had replaced effectively, was kind enough to say to me, I could never have done that. But I was able to do it because I knew how to work the system in the Ministry of Defence. I knew whom to talk to get the kind of messages that we needed. And that was the first one. The second one was ALARM, which was the suppression weapon for the RAF. And that, again, was facing enormous competition. But we won that one. And so suddenly people began to see British Aerospace, certainly the dynamics part, as an extraordinarily successful. I then turned my attention to space, because that was a neglected area, and we won the first non-US satellite for NATO. And so that was a great achievement. About this time, of course, Tim Pearce decided on a review of the organisation, recommendations for a reorganisation, and... I was asked if I would become chief executive managing director of the whole company, as opposed to Dynamics, and I accepted that. I then had to start looking at the aircraft side to see what was going on there. Not a particularly happy story. On the other hand, but we knew that unless we got a new commitment for a fighter out of the Ministry of Defence, we were going to go out of business. So we turned all our energies to getting a fighter, a new fighter. And at that rather famous Farnborough in 1980, whatever it was, we got old John Knott to actually stand up and say that we were going to produce a demonstrator, and it was to be half funded by British Aerospace and half by the government to demonstrate a new fighter for the RAF. And that, of course, became the Tornado in the fullness of time. But what we had forgotten was that although we said we would make this through the partnership, which had been successful in... Have I got the right aeroplane? No. Became the Typhoon in the tornado, then this was Germany and Italy and Spain. And of course the Germans became an enormous stumbling block. We had divided the programme. We would take the front, the Italians would take one wing and the tail, I think the Spanish would take the other wing, or we would, I can't remember now, but it was all divided up. And the whole main empennage of the aircraft was to go to Germany. But the German company at that time, MBB, was a wholly owned subsidiary of the government, and their bureaucrats said, we have no requirement for this aircraft, therefore you can't have any funding. And so there was to be no back end. So Ivan Yates very cleverly took the back end of a tornado and welded it onto the new front end and bits and pieces which we produced as. That's why it looked a very hunchbacked aeroplane. But it was a demonstrator. And it really shook the French to the core, because they didn't believe that we would actually be able to do this. And therefore they thought that they would be able to have the dominant role in Europe. Because the most profitable product in aerospace at that time, maybe still is, was an interceptor fighter, and that everybody wanted, and you could make money out of it if you had the right one. We didn't have the right one. We had nothing from the end of the Hunter. From the Hunter onwards, we had no interceptor fighter. So that was the tide. Now, think how long that's taken to come to fruition. But that's how it started. But there were, it's a long story. There are certain kind of things that you must remember, that LIGO's laws, if you like. The length of time of a project is determined by the number of partners. If you have four partners, it will take four times as long. It will cost four times as much. Because if you think about it, within a democratic society, one of those countries will be having an election at the time. And so everything stops for an election. So that partner stops, and everything stops. The whole program has stopped. But people have to be paid. The factories have to stay open. So the costs go up. And, I mean, you get a program which is totally and utterly unreassembled. And Dassault recognised this very clearly. And that's why they wouldn't join the partnership. In my book, I remember the first episode of this was when they fell out of the... We were then doing a joint air-to-air weapon program with the French and in Europe. And the chap who was running it rang me up one day and said, Ray, I have to tell you, we're going to withdraw from the program. And I said, well, I'm very sorry to hear this. Well, he said, I'm coming over to Heathrow tomorrow to explain it to you. So I met this chap at Heathrow, and he flew in, and so I said, he said, well, Ray, the thing is, with these European partnerships, here we go, it will cost as many times as the partnership, it will take as many times that long, and we think the market is ready for a new air-to-air weapon now, and we will go ahead on our own and produce it, and we'll beat you into the marketplace, and we will win. So I said, oh, I hear what you're saying. He said, of course, your weapon may have a slightly better guidance system. When it comes along, it might have a slightly better fuse. But then he has this marvellous remark, literally. And he said, but when you sell to an Arab, what does it matter? And I thought, but hang about, mate. This weapon is designed for your Air Force and our Air Force. It's not just giant. It's designed for some Arab. And I was shocked. But it explained to me very clearly what the French attitude was to manufacturing products. You know, they were going to make something that would sell, and their Air Force would have to take it, even if it was not perfectly, because they wanted their endorsement, as sold to the French Air Force. But, I mean, it was a revelation to me. It's in my book. Why I've never been sued, I can't imagine. But, I mean, that was the statement this man made. Anyway, it then, you know, we then had a reversion to a socialist government again for a while after Edward Heath, and it became Anglo-French collaboration was to be the flavour of the month. I mean, it was this was before we went solo. This was, and the big project we wanted was a thing called the Anglo-French Variable Geometry Aeroplane. And I was on five Anglo-French management boards. That was one, the Jaguar was another, and there were three helicopter programs, the Puma being one. And out of all this came a totally satisfactory amount of work for the French, and nothing for the British whatsoever, because in the end they bailed out of the Anglo-French geometry era. Why? Because there was another rule at that time, which was a very rule of something. In a carrier, if it was you needed tonnage compared to weight of aircraft launch, and price, was there was a relationship. So a 40,000-ton carrier could operate a 40,000-pound aeroplane, and it would cost you 40 million. Very rough, because it's... But at that time, it wasn't too bad. But the French, of course, with the restrictions in place on their requirement by the capability of the French carriers, always wanted a smaller and less weighty aeroplane than was the requirement for the RAF. And so, you know, that was it. So the French bailed out, and that was... her famous meeting was Heseltine, yet another one, in which he asked me to go and see him, and he had a habit of reclining on his chaise long when he was talking to him. He said, well, the new European Joint Strike Fighter is going to fail, Ray. I said, oh dear, I'm sorry, well, why do you say that? He said, because of one man. And I said, who is that? He said, you. And I said, me? Why is it going to... because you won't do a deal with the French. And I said, Secretary of State, I'll do a deal with anybody that satisfies my shareholders. But I can tell you right now that it's not that I won't do a deal with the French. The French will make such unacceptable claims that we can't do a deal with them. So I went to see Dassault, and sure enough, then I went back to see him again, and in the end I said, I'm terribly sorry. I have to tell you, there's no way. They want to build a thing called the Rafale, and they want us, they're perfectly happy for us to join as a subcontractor, but that's it. And it's not enough. So, in the end, it was decided that the French defence minister, the German defence minister, should arbitrate. And I went over to Germany to face this very nice, very competent German defence minister who died, sadly, nice man. And it started off, and there was Dassault, and there was LIGO, and there was MBB, and Aerospace, whatever they were, all in the background, hardly visible. And virtually it was the French and LIGO sitting next to each other. And there, the German started by saying, now, should we conduct this meeting in French or German or English, or what would you prefer? And I said, I didn't, doesn't bother me. And the Frenchman said, rrr, rrr, rrr. He said, well, I think we'll do it in English. I thought, thank God for that. So he started off by saying, no, I understand, he said, that there is a dispute between you, British Aerospace, and the French over the requirements for this aircraft. And I said, wrong, sir. I said, there's a dispute between the French on the one side, the Germans, the Italians, the Spanish, and the British on the other side. And therefore, if you are to ask any questions, it should be of the French, not of me. We're all agreed. So, of course, it turned the thing on its head. And as a result of this meeting, it was decided that the four nations should go ahead with what has become Typhoon, and the French should go ahead on their own, and they have produced Rafale, of course. So that was one of the major concerns. The other major concern I had was, could we make the civil aircraft side of the business profitable? Very difficult. The nationalisation of the company, the major concern was employment. And so work was distributed right around the whole of raft of British Aerospace, regardless of who or what. And so bits were being made all over the country and assembled in one place. But it meant if you had industrial disturbance in one place, it affected the whole program. So that was one thing. The other thing was that we were, of course, manufacturing low product items or value items in high value sites. And very early on I decided that all sites in the south of England would have to go. And we'd have to concentrate manufacturing and design in the north. And this was very sad for places like Hatfield and Weybridge, but it was inevitable.